We all know war stories from Hollywood blockbusters, nerve-wracking intelligence missions or improbable lucky escapes. And we might think that those characters at the centre of them are pure fiction, just the movies. But sometimes there is also a bit of truth. What if I told you that within the archive here at Kew, there are fascinating stories of real people who lived through the horrors of the Second World War? This is On the Record at the National Archives, uncovering the past through stories of everyday people. I'm Chloe Lee, a migration and citizenship researcher at the National Archives. My colleagues here at Kew have put together an exhibition called Great Escapes, Remarkable Second World War Captives, using some of the unique documents we hold to tell the stories of people who were imprisoned during the war. If you can't make the exhibition or just want to hear more from the specialists that uncovered these stories, we've put together this episode of On the Record. I'm going to hear the stories of four people that we couldn't include in full in the exhibition. I've invited three specialists into the podcast studio to tell me their stories, using some primary sources, photographs, and even secret spy letters. Let's get started. My first guest is Will Butler, a specialist in British society during the First and Second World Wars and the history of the British Army. Welcome to the podcast, Will.
Thank you very much, Chloe. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm good. And how are you? The builders are in for your big piece of work coming out soon.
They are. It's incredibly exciting. It's great to see the work come together after many months of research. Fascinating research, of course.
But it's great. Great. And who are you here to tell me about today?
I'm here to tell you the story about Arthur Britton, who was a stretcher bearer at Dunkirk in France in May 1940. He became a prisoner of war during that month and also was eventually appointed the prisoner of war camp pastor. Mm. So he was responsible for the religious needs of his fellow prisoners of war.
I see. So what is the story? Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, of course. So Arthur is a really interesting character. I fell in love with his story and I'm wanting to tell that story in detail as much as I could. So he was from County Durham in northeast England. He was a motor fitter before the war. And at the time of his captivity, he was 37 years old. So he was a little older than a lot of the soldiers around him. He initially was responsible for military logistics. So he was actually sent to France at the end of September 1939, so very close to the start of the war. Mm. And then by March 1940, he was transferred to what was called the 14th Field Ambulance and was responsible for transporting the wounded, essentially. And throughout the chaos in May 1940, the Allied retreats towards Dunkirk and the eventual withdrawal from mainland Europe for Allied forces, he found himself as a prisoner of war. He was initially reported as missing, and then eventually, according to his records, was reported as a prisoner of war on the 24th of May, 1940. And he spent almost five full years in captivity. So essentially one of those individuals, tens of thousands of individuals really, who were in captivity for almost the entire duration of the war.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned he was a bit older than the rest of the kind of people that would have been maybe captured alongside him. Can you tell us, how do we know about this story?
So we hold at the National Archives his prisoner of war identity card, essentially. We have a series of cards here. There's about 200,000 of these cards that we hold, some of which have a photograph of the individual, and Arthur's does have a photograph, and that always brings things to life that little bit.
Can you remember more. What he looks like? What does the photograph give away?
He was a similar age to me now, and I always feel that he looks a lot fitter than I am. He's smiling in the photograph, which is interesting. These cards were created after individuals became prisoners of war. At that stage, it's early on in his prisoner of war life and experiences. He looks fairly healthy. He looks fit at that stage. And obviously that does change over the duration of the war. He's held in central Poland for most of his captivity. And again, he pops up in a few different records that we hold at the National Archives. We have his service record here, which gives us some information about that. But he also then turns up in a number of the camp records that we hold. So the Red Cross, which is a charity organization responsible for looking after in some kind of way the welfare of prisoners of war and they carried out inspections of camps all over Europe and indeed the world. And Arthur turns up in some of those reports as well, partly because of his role as a Presbyterian minister, essentially, in the camp.
And you mentioned there's 400 prisoners alongside him in this camp and that he became the pastor. What was daily life like in those POW camps for him?
He was in a particular camp. He was in a working camp. The full name, which, and apologies for my pronunciation, is the Bau- und Arbeitsbattalion 21, or BAB 21 for short. And this was a working camp whereby prisoners were put to work, in this case, at an oil refinery. So it's an industrial complex, and prisoners were permitted to work under international law. If they were prisoners of war, they could be put to work, especially if they weren't an officer, which Arthur wasn't, and the individuals around him weren't either. And they had to work 6 days a week. They were given a small payment for that work. But actually, because of Arthur's role as the pastor, it got him out of some of that work because his time is then dominated in that way.
His fellow prisoners would have appointed him, voted him in.
Essentially, and certainly before the war, he had a role in his local Presbyterian church in County Durham. And so obviously that put him in a good position to be able to carry out that function. And there was a small chapel essentially in the camp where he would then hold then Sunday services at the camp for those around him.
What impact did it have on Arthur? Have you got any more information about that?
Absolutely. And there are a few events that happened during his time as a prisoner of war that are a kind of crucial in terms of shaping his own experience. In particular, because the camp was on an industrial complex, it was vulnerable to air attack. And actually, the US Air Force bombed the camp a few times during 1944 in particular. And there was a particular raid which occurred in early December 1944, which killed a large number, or a relatively large number, of those prisoners held, Allied prisoners held in the camp. It killed 26 individuals, later 28, and injured a further 28. And again, we are able to get in the records to pick up Arthur's story in some of the letters that are written as a result of this raid. And he's specifically listed with two others for quoted as voluntarily carrying out the necessary but painful task of preparing the dead for burial. And I think that's very clear that his role as the pastor of the camp, he's taking on this responsibility, this very serious responsibility and very difficult task beyond his everyday caring role that he has. And we know that Arthur took these experiences with him beyond the war, as did a large number of prisoners of war and internees took these experiences into their post-war life. And I've been lucky enough to be in contact with Arthur's grandson, who's provided us with some additional information, which it's always fantastic to research these stories in the archive, but then to be able to have someone who can bring a little more colour and life to the individual that you're researching.
The living archive.
Is incredible. And one of the things that he gave me, or he gave a copy of to me, was a newspaper clipping. So when Arthur was appointed as the pastor of the camp, news of that was disseminated to his local area, to his next of kin. And the fact that he was appointed the pastor was reported in the local press. And we know, and I know from his grandson, that newspaper clipping Arthur carried with him in his wallet for the rest of his life. And I think that's a real kind of testament to that experience, the pride that he had in the position that he had in the camp as well, and the kind of legacy of that experience on him for the rest of his life.
Will, what is it like for you as a researcher to connect these original documents, which in themselves are very moving, with people in real life?
Realistically, it's a real privilege in a lot of ways to have these conversations with people who are connected to the documents and to the individuals that I research on a daily basis. And we have this kind of contact quite often here at the National Archives. People are here all the time researching their family history, and of course they want to tell us their stories. But it very rarely happens the other way, that I'm doing the research on an individual and then I'm able to actually make contact with a relative or a relation of the person I'm researching. And we have to obviously treat that delicately. But the hope is that we do those stories justice, and particularly in the context of the exhibition. I certainly hope that we've been able to do that.
That's great. Thank you, Will, for sharing that with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Chloe.
Next up is my colleague, Ella Kaczmarska, a specialist in Polish and modern Jewish history. Welcome to the podcast, Ella.
Hello, nice to be here.
So whose story are you sharing with us today?
This is the story of Peter Gardner. He was a Spitfire pilot and he bailed out of his Spitfire in July 42. And so he spent some time in Offlags before he was transferred to Salaglov 3. And there he became involved in intelligence work. And he wrote some secret messages, which we found.
I heard you made quite an amazing discovery in the archive.
I'll confess, actually, it was Will who made the discovery. He was looking at files for a visit by some delegates. And this file was dated 1953. And when he opened it, he realised there was more to it than information on South Korea. So he passed the research over on to me, because the first document you come to in this file is a handwritten copy of a code, one of the codes which MI9 devised in the early years of the war. And the code that has been transcribed into this file is the one that's most extensively used. So obviously this person who was involved in decoding perhaps for the Korean conflict had copied and used the same code. So Will handed it to me. And I think when we look more closely into the file, we realise that we don't even know how this information got into that file. But we realised that this was a really unique find. It was full of really lovely letters, which were written from a prisoner of war to his mother. And then there were these photographs, not large photographs, small photographs. And we found them in these sort of old brown envelopes.
So these were just loose. How big were they?
These were just loose. They must have been the size of half a postcard, I think. Probably about that size. But within that little envelope were things like, I find a little hand-drawn map on tracing paper of the area of Saarbrücken, for example. I found this.
And Saarbrücken is where, sorry?
So that's in Germany. So that was in Germany. And also this little bit of tissue paper, which was so delicate. It obviously had been through conservation at some point in its lifetime, being here in the archives. But it was, you couldn't read it. You couldn't read it with the naked eye. And it looked as if somebody had literally just put little dots on this bit of tissue paper. And then, of course, we found the photo stats, which must have been created at the same time. And they were transcripts of what was written on these bits of tissue paper. And these, in fact, were the secret messages that were sent from the camp, Salaglov 3, which is now in Poland, near a town called Poznań.
So this bundle, effectively, of photographs and tissue paper, letters, they're all from a POW, I assume, from a POW camp. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yes, they are. They're written by Peter Gardner to his mother, these letters. And he must have had some arrangement with his mother about writing letters home, because there are codes within the actual letter he sends to his mother. This is really how the story of Peter Gardner's secret messages emerged. The fact that actually he was definitely working in the intelligence side of things from the camp. And these messages would have definitely eventually got to MI9, because there are handwritten memos at the bottom which suggest that they have actually seen them.
So can we assume then that's why we have them in our archive, because they passed from his mother into the hands of government and intelligence services?
Yes. So we don't have the original letters that the mother received, but we have the photo stats of them, the copies of them.
Which are photo stats are basically copies of, aren't they?
Yeah. It was like the old-fashioned photocopying used to do on banding machines, I think. Yeah. They tell us an awful lot. They just talk about, I miss you. It's like Blackpool here, a sea of brown bodies. So the contents of the letter just don't really fit to what a prisoner of war camp should look like. So he's obviously passing these sort of secret codes, I think, on very likely onto his mother. And his mother would have said, okay, there's something in this letter which means I have to pass this on, because there's something in the photograph.
I see.
And the photographs, what he did with other forgers in the camp, I would imagine, is that he dismantled the photograph, the backing, and he slid this little piece of tissue paper, which was absolutely tiny, in between the photo and the backing.
So what we've got are these letters that seem not quite like the kind of letters you would write your mother if you were in a camp.
It's really what's in the secret message that counts here. And these secret messages, if I just describe a little bit what they look like, lots of punctuation. There's no paragraphs. They are about the size of perhaps an A4 sheet, most of these letters. They're quite lengthy. Lots of numbers, lots of single words as well. So they will have contained details such as food rations, morale in the camp, acknowledgements of receipt of parcels, requests for specific items needed for intelligence work. So things like black ink. And there's a really lovely quote here, which is just an example of what you can expect to find in these secret messages. So I'll read that out to you. Escape Organization Forgery Department had marked success with various documents supplied to a number of escapees on the 5th of March, but of considerable difficulty obtaining originals to copy. Therefore, request tracing of identity card for foreign workers in Germany. Leave passed. Ditto. Suggest suitable paper as fly leaves in books. Request also powdered Indian ink, 3 very fine mapping nibs.
Wow. So he's really supporting escape, Peter.
He is, yeah. He's absolutely supporting escape. But he's also, in these coded messages, characterising a lot of new arrivals. Mm. So these new arrivals are mentioned in some of his secret messages. And they describe individuals, and some of them are Polish, some of them South African. Whichever airman arrived at the camp at the time would have a sort of a characterization by Peter Gardner or by other intelligence officers and supplying Peter with the information, which he then put into his secret message. And he would describe, first of all, he would say the squadron number of the airmen and their airbase. And then he would follow with a little comment. So we've got one here, which is he's described as silent and unapproachable. There's another one saying foxy and bitter.
Wow, yeah. What a description.
Then you've got obviously intelligent and informed. And one here from Northolt, young, quite helpless type. So you really want to ask yourself, why is he making this analysis? And I would imagine when this letter gets back to, whether it be MI9 or via the airbase or what have you, they would consider the person, whether that person would be suitable or not suitable for intelligence work within the camp.
So is he acting like a kind of recruiter?
Possibly. It's difficult to say because not only does he talk about individual people, he talks about the lists of books that they need to have. And of course, a lot of books were used for coding purposes. He's asking for certain things, which unless you really know how to decode using the coded messages, which I understand many researchers have tried to do, it's not an easy task.
That is really like something out of the movies. So like turn to page 29, third line down, 3 across, kind of thing.
Yeah, we've got an example of a dictionary that was used for coding, which we found in our archives. And it's still difficult to understand how these things worked. What we do know is that there were many people in the camp who knew how to learn. Messages were hidden in various ways. Prisoners of war were allowed to have letters sent to them, and they were also allowed to have letters that they could send out to, hence Peter's letters to his mother. So they could be disguised in many different ways. A lot of letters had their own codes. So some people had already arranged with their loved ones that they would use some kind of coding system before leaving on a mission, for example. But the main codes that were used for intelligence purposes were those that were devised, as I mentioned earlier, by MI9. There were 10 codes in total. And coding really was literally by way of writing. Mm. Later on, the codes were actually used for radio.
So you've mentioned MI9. For those of us that aren't so familiar with the intelligence services, can you tell us how did intelligence gathering work during the war and specifically for POWs in camps like this?
It became clear very early on that there had to be an intelligence unit which dealt with escape and evasion. So what happened was that the chiefs of MI5, MI6 and the Naval Intelligence Division, they all met to discuss the establishment of MI9. And that came into being in December 1939. Intelligence was necessary for many reasons. Primarily, actually, a lot of investment had gone into training servicemen. With the relative safety net of the protection from the Geneva Convention, evading capture and attempting escape was very much encouraged. Mm. And the escape and evasion lectures actually began in January 1940. And these essentially were very practical tips for the evader and escaper, which focused on cultural differences and behaviours, learning basic phrases in foreign languages like French, German, Spanish, Polish.
So any servicemen would just attend these lectures?
So, yes. So anyone would, they had to attend lectures. They would have lectures, for example, the airmen would have at the air bases. And these lectures would be delivered by trained officers. And many of them actually had actually experienced escape. And Airy Neave was one of those who, in fact, Airy Neave did join, was recruited by MI9. But there were people who were delivering, had some experience of escape and evasion. They were given a handbook. Handbooks were not distributed to every officer at all. They were quite selective who they gave them to. And these handbooks had to be updated on a regular basis with the intelligence that was coming out of the camps and from people who'd successfully evaded capture and those who were successful in their escapes. Some of the things that were really key to the success was knowing the locations of the camps mm-hmm. and their surrounding areas.
Yeah.
And that was obviously paramount to any escape. So these routes needed to be discovered and duly mapped. As well as maps, there were escape aids. We now commonly refer them to as gadgets. These were smuggled into camps in various ingenious ways.
Ella, what was it like to make that discovery and find those kind of things in the archive?
When I managed to read the file cover to cover, I decided to look into other documentation about Peter Gardner. And one of the things we found out that actually he was a good friend of Guy Griffiths. And Guy Griffiths, who was also in Stalag Luv 3, and we could actually match up the fact that one of the photographs that he sent to his mother with the hidden message behind it was of Guy Griffiths. And I think this led us to explore other avenues of risk. And that was really exciting.
Yeah, it seems like there's lots of different ways out of this one find. Codes, intelligence.
Tentacles coming out all over the place.
Thanks, Ella, for coming in. Great to hear this story from you.
And thank you for the opportunity.
Now, for our next story, I'll need to welcome a new guest into the studio, Roger Kershaw, a specialist in modern migration records at the National Archives. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Chloe.
Great to have you here today. Who are you here to tell me about?
I want to talk about the foreign nationals who were in Britain when the war broke out and how they were treated. First is a woman called Theresia Tekla Maria Cook, who was from Germany, and the second is an Austrian named Peter Stadlin. When Britain declared war on Germany in 1939, overnight, over 70,000 Austrian and German nationals resident in the UK were deemed to be enemy aliens. Over 40,000 were male, and over 30,000 were female. Internment tribunals were set up to examine them all and decide what to do with them.
We're going to touch back on what we mean by this term enemy aliens, because it seems to come up a lot. But first, who was Theresia?
So Theresia Cook was one of the Germans who had to be examined to determine whether she posed a threat to Britain. Now, what we know about Theresia is that she was born in 1903 in Oldenburg, Germany. She left Germany in 1922 because of the German recession, and she wanted to gain what she called was world experience. And initially, she worked in Holland as a nurse and midwife before moving to the UK in 1931.
So here we've got someone, a woman of the world, trying to get away from economic hardship in where she was born, her home. She's in Britain. So why was she interned, a nurse, someone of this kind of role or calibre?
On the 29th of August 1939, Theresia applied for naturalisation. A few weeks later, following the UK declaration of war on Germany, as an enemy alien, Cook sat before an internment tribunal where she made clear her anti-Nazi and pro-British feelings. And the board was satisfied that she posed no threat to UK security and was granted Category C on the 7th of November by Judge Austin Jones at Bromley Tribunal. Even though she wasn't interned, she had to follow certain rules.
And that's part of the Category C that she gets. Can you explain the differences between the categories for enemy aliens at this time?
Sure. So Category A was where somebody was deemed to be a threat and they were interned. They were put into an internment camp and they were kept under supervision. Category B was somewhere in between both Category C, which is where a decision was made not to intern. So Category B, for example, people would be monitored more closely and they'd have to report more regularly than those in Category C.
And did anyone spring to Teresia's defence throughout this whole process?
They did, but it wasn't until the spring of 1940. So in 1940, Teresia was employed as a housekeeper to Hugh Shaler. And Hugh Shaler was a parliamentary agent for the Labour Party, and he was living in Sidcup. She was cohabiting with him and assisting him with his secretarial work. And he was married, but he was living apart. And they met as early as 1935, we know that, at Buckhurst Youth Hostel. There were several complaints made to the police at the time, alleging that there were unscreened lights at their dwelling, and both were members of a nudist camp. And in fact, Cook had visited a nudist camp on the Isle of Wight in 1940, but she hadn't notified the police that she'd done that, and that's something she should have done.
So she should have done that as part of being Category C. She would have had to report where she was going, her movements, things like that.
Exactly, because she was still an enemy alien. So what happened in July 1940, there was an order for her internment and it was issued.
And is that because she broke the kind of rules of her kind of categorisation?
Exactly. She'd broken the rules around alien registration in several respects. And even though her neighbours had complained on moral grounds, that wasn't really part of the decision. As she lived in an area of strategic importance, the committee thought it was in the interest of the country that she was interned.
I see. And did Teresia's story have a wider impact?
It did. Initially, Teresia was sent to Holloway, and she was awaiting internment to the Isle of Man, where she went in 1940. And she was transferred to a women's internment camp at Port Erin. And in August 1940, her local MP, Jenny Anderson, wrote to the Home Secretary, Osbert Peake, asking that she be released, as she didn't pose any threat. And Shaler even petitioned John Anderson. Now, John Anderson was the Secretary of State of Home Affairs and the Ministry of Home Security, and he was actually nicknamed the Home Front Prime Minister. And Cook's appeal was heard in September 1941, and there was a recommendation for her release, and that was authorised by the Home Secretary in October of that year. And we have a full transcript of this hearing, and it also includes the examination of evidence offered by Hugh Shaler. Her case is like thousands of others, and they helped pave the way for Osbert Peake's white paper, which was called Civilian Internees of Enemy Nationality. And that paper identified categories of persons who could be eligible for release. By 1942, fewer than 5,000 remained interned, mainly on the Isle of Man. So after the war, like so many other internees, Teresia settled in Britain, and she successfully applied for naturalisation in 1953. And Hugh Shaler was one of the referees supporting her application, which was successful. They never married, but we know that she changed her name to Teresia Tekla Maria Cook Shaler in later life.
Okay, that's such an interesting story that we have here at the archive. So, Roger, what records do we have of her?
So we actually have her personal file, and that includes reference to her life before, during, and after internment. And this record was actually closed until 2054, but I applied under the Freedom of Information Act, and they opened it early, and anybody can do that.
So that next person that you mentioned was Austrian. Can you tell me a bit more?
Yes, his name is Peter Karl Theodor Stadlen. Peter also has a personal file, and his file was recently opened again under the Freedom of Information Act. And it tells the story of those foreign nationals who were actually deported. Peter was born in 1910, and he was a Jewish refugee from Austria. He fled to the Netherlands in March 1938, following the Anschluss, which is when Nazi Germany annexed the neighbouring country of Austria. Peter was a renowned concert pianist, and he performed in Amsterdam before moving to the UK in July 1939. And we know that, like thousands of others resident in the southern strip of England, Peter was interned in June 1940, and he was taken to a camp on the Isle of Man, and many campaigned for his release, including the British composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. Now, he described Peter as a musician of the highest quality, and that his presence in this country is a great addition to our cultural life.
So Peter's interned on the Isle of Man with Jewish refugees. Anyone else, Roger?
Yes, Jewish refugees, but also actually pro-Nazi Germans.
So you've got a real mix of people there, all interned in the same camp. And then what happens?
They were deported to Canada and some were deported to Australia, but they actually mixed the pro-Nazis with the Jewish refugees. And Peter was one of those who was deported to Australia.
So despite people campaigning for his release, he was still put on that boat to Australia?
He was. He went to Australia. And on that same journey was another Jewish refugee called Haino Alexander. And we've got his personal diary at the National Archives. And we've recently translated it. And he describes a harrowing journey.
What language was he writing?
He was writing in German, and we had it translated. So I can just read one of the passages. This is what he says. "Now, on the 10th of July, towards the evening, we have reached Liverpool and saw from a distance the ship that is to take us to Canada. Then the reception on the Dunera was a shock. All the luggage we had with us, we were all allowed £80, was torn out of our hands and dumped in a huge pile. Our pockets were searched and things stolen. We even got kicked and hit with rifle butts, if anyone was not quick enough. Then we were driven down by the troops on the ship, rounded up like cattle and packed onto individual decks. The worst thing was that we were sitting behind barbed wire. Here, below deck, it was shocking. Everything, absolutely everything, was taken from anyone who appeared even a little well-to-do. Papers and important documents were torn up and thrown away. We numbered some 2,600 people, crammed together like cattle."
Wow, so that really is such a harrowing story from told by Haino. And we can't even imagine Peter's journey to Britain escaping in 1938 anyway, and then to be forced onto this ship. But you said they were heading to Australia, but you just mentioned Canada?
They were to go to Canada, but unbeknown to them, only a few days earlier, another ship called the Arundora Star had been torpedoed and over 800 people had lost their lives.
So that route was deemed too dangerous for deportees.
That's right. So they turned their attention to Australia.
So was that route to Australia less dangerous?
No, it wasn't. And in fact, it took longer. It took a total of 58 days. And Haino records in his diary on the 12th of July, so only 2 days after sailing, he says this. He says, "Early in the morning, I was wakened by a dreadful noise, and shortly after came a terrible crash. Afterwards, we learnt that two torpedoes had been fired at our ship, but thank God, due to the height of the waves, did not reach their target. We could not have hoped to be rescued, for first of all, we were locked in barbed wire, and we would all have been squashed to death. And secondly, there were guards at all the exits to the deck with their guns loaded, and they would have shot down anybody who tried to break through the barbed wire. There were clearly not enough lifeboats on board for everyone. We never had any lifeboat drills, so you can guess what would have happened in the event of an emergency."
It sounds absolutely harrowing to be on board that ship. So did Peter arrive in Australia? What happened after that?
Peter arrived in Sydney in Australia, and he was taken to a camp in New South Wales, which is called the Hay Internment Camp. And he stayed there for about a year, and then he came back to the UK.
And what happened to Peter after the war?
He was released like thousands of others. And in 1947, like Theresia, he took out British nationality. And we've got his naturalisation file as well. So he became a British citizen in 1947. And he actually became a music critic for the Daily Telegraph. And he remained in this country until his death in the 1990s.
Thanks so much, Roger, for coming in. I think that's such an important element of these stories to cover.
No problem.
Thanks, Roger, and to Will and Ella too. That's all we have time for in this episode. These are just four stories that sit alongside those featured in the exhibition Great Escapes, which is open at the National Archives until July 21st, 2024. The exhibition explores the human spirit in times of captivity during the Second World War. It's free and it's right here at our building in Kew. Thanks for listening to On the Record from the National Archives. To find out more about the National Archives, follow the link from the episode description in your podcast listening app. Visit nationalarchives.gov.uk to subscribe to On the Record at the National Archives so you don't miss new episodes, which are released throughout the year. Listeners, we need your help to make this podcast better. We need to know a bit more about you and what themes you're interested in. You can share this information with us by visiting smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. That's smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. We'll include that link in the episode description and on our website. You can also share your feedback or suggestions for future series by emailing us at ontherecord@nationalarchives.gov.uk. Finally, thank you to all our experts who contributed to this episode. This episode was written, edited, and produced by Tash Walker and Adam Smith of Aunt Nell for the National Archives. This podcast from the National Archives is Crown copyright. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License. You'll hear from us soon.